Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
Okay, so Victoria, May Blossom of Britannia, England, 1829. And this one is by Anna Kirwan. And there is no summary, so I've decided to make up my own.
Capital idea.
Let me just pull it up here. So my made-up summary is, starting at the age of 10, we see how Princess Victoria grows up inside Kensington Palace. Through her diary entries, the princess offers a glimpse of courtly customs, royal power struggles, political plotting, and her ultimate accession to becoming Queen of England.
Wow.
Thank you.
Not that bad.
I mean, how difficult was it for her to write one? Apparently it was too difficult. Or maybe it was Scholastic. They just dropped the ball on this one.
I think maybe. I mean, that's sort of my impression.
Okay. So, let's just be cards on the table about this. Queen Victoria has been a fave of mine since I was a small child. But like anything, that when you like it when you're a small child, that obviously grows and evolves as you grow up and you encounter more and more stuff. So, you know, it's kind of like hero worshiping and, you know, an adult in your life or someone, and you idolize them in a way. And then as you become a grown up and then you start to get to know them more as a flawed human being, you're like, oh my.
Or, you know, I love Marie Antoinette. She is my Scorpio LARPing walking disaster.
Yes. So I have an interesting take on Queen Victoria, just because she is a difficult subject to cover, especially in a podcast, and I didn't want to do a two-parter, because let's be honest, she reigned over such a long period of time, and there was such immense social, political, economic change throughout the world. So if you cover this time of history in England when she was reigning, and by extension the British Empire, that's a lot of stuff, and like, ain't nobody got time for that. Well, we do have time for it, but not in this context. And then if we just want to talk about Victoria as a person, that's a whole other thing, because she was born in 1819. She died in 1901. Mm-hmm. And in that time frame, even for herself, so much was happening. And she was actually a very prolific IRL writer. So she actually wrote 122 volumes of diaries and journals in her lifetime.
Oof.
And even though they were sort of culled and censored by her youngest daughter, Beatrice, after her death, it's still a huge amount of documentation to go through. And then I was like, ain't nobody got time for that. So I didn't do that either. So before I get into my new way of how I'm approaching Queen Victoria, let's discuss this book.
This book.
What do you remember reading this one?
I remember reading this one. I remember thinking, because my exposure to Queen Victoria came through a combination of, there was still the To Be a Princess book, and we've talked about it before in the Elizabeth episode. There also, Marie Antoinette was featured in that book, but then also,
always comes back to Marie Antoinette with you.
Of course it is. It always does. But another thing, too, is that there was also A&E producer Victoria and Albert miniseries. And I think that was really when you were starting to climb up the mountain of your Victorian interest.
Yeah.
And so me being the younger sibling, it's like, this is debuting. We are watching this family. And so then I was sitting next to you on the couch. So then that was the thing. But they really skipped over a lot of the boring crap of her childhood. At least it was boring to me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to go and read this book, I remember thinking, like, this is fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember reading it, but I couldn't go and tell you what I thought about it.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a non-event.
So for me, because by the time this book came out, I was already sort of like a Victoria fangirl. So I was just like, yeah, a book about her. I'm excited. And I read this book and I was just like, maybe my expectations were high.
Probably.
I think it was like, I was excited to sort of be like, ooh, I get to know this side of Victoria, like her as a child, and like we're roughly around that same age and blah, blah, blah. But really, I found like reading straight up proper biography stuff more captivating than this. So yeah, it was pretty lackluster. But what did you think about reading it again now?
I think one of the better ones now in the series.
Interesting. Why do you think that?
Couple of reasons. One, there's some days when you go, and we've talked about this before, is how do you go and get the voice of a teenage girl and make it actually sound, both on one hand, she's of her time, but also does she sound like a real person, but does she also sound somebody her own age?
Yeah, and she's young in this book, too. She's like 10.
Yeah, it goes over 2 years from 10 to 12. And I think that this book actually does it really successfully, from the underlining to the writing in all caps.
Yeah.
To she's so judicious at first that I'm going to write every day. And then how she writes up about it. Plus also, I mean, we've all been, no one is sitting down for 3 freaking hours to go and write about this one thing. I never did that when I was, I still journal. I still don't do that as I'm journaling.
Yeah.
And so then, okay, the next day, I'll finish telling you about this big thing. It felt very authentically written in its style. Like, she understands the genre of what does it mean to go and write a fictional diary.
Yeah, I think two things that probably really helped are, because in real life Victoria was a prolific writer, we have documentation of how she actually wrote. So the underlining and the all caps and using the short form for V dot, like to say very instead of writing very, like those are quirks that are in her real writing. So mm-hmm. I think that probably helped a lot for capturing that voice. And then there is also the whole thing too where Victoria's mother was insistent that she keep a diary, but it wasn't private, and she would read it. Sort of, it was like almost like an exercise, you know, write in your journal every day, and then her mom would just read it because Victoria had like little to no privacy about mm-hmm. anything. So it's just the idea of, okay, we know in real life this age Victoria had a real diary, mm-hmm. but now we're making a fictitious version of it. How do we make it like she has this fake diary? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah.
So I think it was, I think she did a really good job of saying, this is my secret diary, and I won't be able to write in it as often because, you know, I have to hide it. And, you know, also true to form, she's like, this isn't a big passion project for me, because in the vein of if she's being forced to write a real journal every day, the idea of like sitting down to diary some more probably was a bummer. I also liked how it was like the cows would mm-hmm. show up randomly in the list.
Also, this book does go and show the great return of excellent food descriptions. I'm all about the food descriptions. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, Victoria was into food, too, so.
I mean, I don't really blame her. If I was rich and
she's
I
like,
had
berries and cream.
Well, if I was rich and I had a really good cook, I too would probably be into food. She never had to labor around food or labor ever really in her life.
It's true. And I mean, and I'll get into this. I'm going to briefly touch on her childhood, but this book was very true to form because she is a more contemporary subject. There is more documentation and she documented herself.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot to work with. And
yeah.
And I think she did a good job.
I mean, she was, you know, kind of Instagram filtered her life, though, by going and asking her daughter to destroy certain papers, which, you know, legit.
Well, and also her daughter actually was like, I'm going to edit some of this stuff. Like, you, mom, you're talking about how you like to have sex too much. I'm just going to this out.
Yeah, but also, like, Victoria requested stuff too as well. Like, she knew.
Yeah, she knew how to make, she knew what she was about, which was defining image. And I think there's the other element for us too. So we're in Canada, and Canada was founded as a country, you know.
Dominion
of Canada and whatever. Under her reign. So there's a lot of the social structure stuff that we are sort of baked into how we do stuff here
mm-hmm.
that for a lot of people, if it's, well, why do we do it this way? I'm like, probably because of the Victorians.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the time to know about the Victorians, you get a better insight that way. But then the more you study about a time period, the more you can't unknow about like the real realities for a lot of the people in the Victorian time. Like, it was a really garbage time for a lot of people at home quote unquote, and abroad.
I know. I mean, I kind of really love the general whitewashing of even some of her personal life stuff, too, that happens at the very back of the book.
Oh, yeah. And they're just... like, things were hard, but don't worry. There were amazing things, too. It's true. There was a yin-yang, but I think too many times it's presented as there's good and there's bad.
And so, no, like, we are actively choosing a lot of this bad.
Yeah. So, and as you read this stuff, you can sort of naturally compartmentalize. Like, sure, working conditions were terrible in factories, but don't worry, they passed labor laws and children under 10 couldn't work in a factory anymore. Yay! Or, sure, mechanized warfare is being engaged against tribal groups in Africa, but how much say or insight did the people who are actually living in London have about this stuff? You know, we try to, like, very separate out that stuff. This is where my approach with this and how I'm going to look at this is actually almost like one of those personal re-examinations and excavation that had happened, even for myself, going through this sort of stuff. Because I did a lot of that, too, because, like, there's the reality of the Victorian era in one pile, and then there's Queen Victoria in another, you know, and sure, there was stuff that she engaged in that, you know, oh, that's maybe a little problematic. But, you know, in general, the way, especially how she was presented at the time, and even more so, there's sort of this resurgence of her in the media. It still tends to be a very, like you said, sanitized, nothing too bad about it kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is me also saying, if you like something, it's not a condemnation of you as a person and blah, blah, blah. I like the art, the culture, the general vibes of Victoriana. Mm-hmm. Like, it vibes with me. You know, I love floral decor, a well-placed fern. Mm-hmm. I don't think that means I'm a bad person, but it is something that you can't just say, oh, I only want to engage in this stuff. You keep that other stuff.
Yeah.
So, like I said, before I followed the trail of Victoria, who is maybe not talked about as much, there is the first image that was created in her lifetime and evolved as she went through different phases of her reign. When she's young, her image was, look how Britain is saved by this young, beautiful virgin queen, unspoiled by corruption and age. And then as a mother, look, she's an ideal middle-class woman. Sure, she's a queen, but she has the values of home and family with 9 children securing a future. Mm-hmm. And then she was the widow of Windsor, so sad. She lost her one true love, and she's reclusive, and she's all wearing black. And then in her golden and diamond jubilees, she's a status of stability and the grandmother of Europe, and look how long our empire will last kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at her death, it really was a passing of an era that only got romanticized further, like I said, now more so. So the second Victoria is one that a lot of people have probably encountered in recent years, sort of the, did you know that she was young and vivacious? Mm-hmm. And we have a movie and we have a miniseries all about that.
It's true, because we had Victoria and Albert starring the superior
Firth, in our opinion.
And the superior Victoria with Victoria Hamilton. And for those of us, of our younger listeners who are wondering, who's Victoria Hamilton? She played the Queen Mother in the first 2 seasons of The Crown.
She crushed it.
Yeah, best freaking part. Actually, 95% of the reason I tuned into The Crown was because of Victoria Hamilton.
I was like, you have me a Victoria Hamilton. And then there was the Young Victoria movie with Emily Blunt. That was, you know, and Julianne Fellowes, who wrote Downton Abbey, was, you know, at the helm of that one. I poo-poo on that one because Albert did not take a real-life bullet for her. He would have, but the gun wasn't loaded, so why did you do that? And Rupert Friend did a great job being Albert, I'll just say. And then obviously we have the Victoria miniseries that's just come out with Jenna Coleman and her...
It's not a miniseries. It's a full-on...
It's a full-on multi-season... Fine. Multi-season series with her, like, crazy blue contacts that just creep me out. So anyways, that is more the Victoria now that a lot of people are getting to know. And it's... She's just like us. And that was very much the image that was put out in her lifetime, which was... Royalty, they're just like us. Mm-hmm. So before we get into all that, let's meet little Vic, aka the girl who is in this book. Born in Kensington Palace on May 24th, 1819. That's why you celebrate May 24 in Canada. Queen Victoria was originally Alexandrina Victoria after her godfather, Tsar Alexander I, but she preferred to go by her second name, or her nickname was Drina. At birth, she was the 5th in line of succession to the British crown, behind the 4 eldest sons of George III, including her 3 uncles and her father, Edward. She was the only child of a second marriage of Princess Victoire Saxe-Coburg to Edward, Duke of Kent. and her father died when she was 8 months old.
Oof.
Yeah.
Do we know how he died?
He caught cold. It's the most Victorian Regency era way of dying.
Yeah.
So let's be honest. Her childhood is accurately showcased in this book. She was pretty much alone except for Conroy's children, and the strict Kensington system was put in place for two reasons. Number one, there were legitimate fears about protecting the heir and keeping her untainted from the influence of her Hanoverian uncles. Let's be honest, they were pretty selfish and pretty self-indulgent. And number two, John Conroy hoped to manipulate her to further gain power and influence by, if I make Victoria more of a child and infantile and dependent on her mother, therefore him, he was running the household as a favor to his former dead boss, mm-hmm. the Duke of Kent, then he would essentially be the power behind the power.
I mean, on one hand, you gotta appreciate the hustle in that. On the other hand, that is very alarming.
He bet big, and it did not pay off for him. But it didn't matter because she was able to assume the throne in her own right at the age of 18. She became Queen of England. But the throne she inherited was weak and unpopular.
You know, one thing, though, in reading this book, mostly because we did have talked quite a bit about who got decent educations and who didn't, I will say, obviously, going and isolating a small child from other people her own age and never allowing her to be alone, psychological abuse if there ever was one.
Oh, yeah.
However, I will go and say, at least they were like, we want to go make her dependent, but we don't want her to be stupid, which I think might have also backfired on them, though, because she's not stupid. She is well-educated. So because of that, you know.
Well, and also, she was very strong-willed. So it took her a little bit of time to live down sort of the irreverence with how the nation viewed her grandfather, who is quote-unquote Mad King George, mm-hmm. and then her Hanoverian uncles who took over. So you had, like, the Prince of Wales, who was cruelly called the Prince of Wales with an H because he was very overweight. Then you had her uncle, washed-up pineapple head.
Oh, God.
Head was shaped like a pineapple. So it was just, like, essentially, who is this young child person that's, oh, great, now they have a child coming to the throne. But she was very, very strong-willed, and that worked in her favor in sometimes, but then other times it really backfired because she was pretty headstrong and emotionally immature. Even though it was a constitutional monarchy, Victoria did attempt to influence government policy and ministerial appointments publicly. She became, like, a national icon who then became identified with strict standards of personal morality. The idea of being a model citizen and mother really came through with her marriage to her first cousin, Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. A lot of what's focused on with Victoria, like this young Victoria, is her relationship with Albert.
Of course. Because don't you know, a woman is only ever really defined by her relationship to men, even when she is the queen.
I know. Well, and let's be honest, like, I also forgot to mention, the critical factor for me about why the Annie, Victoria, and Albert is the superior young Victoria story mm-hmm. is because it does take the time to get to know, see the push-pull of their relationship, and then critically, too, it doesn't make Melbourne into this hot, zaddy character.
But I just want
to... He was actually like a surrogate dad to her, not in a creep factor way.
I know. I do have to say that part of the reason why I couldn't really go and get through most of even the first season of that, I was like, excuse me, you do not roll up in here with Rufus Sewell, who I've had a big thing for since I was a small child, and I was like, what is this?
And we're sidelining him?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. Because also, in my mind, is that, no, Lord Melbourne is a nice, gentle father figure to her, who she's been, like, desperately missing ever since her Uncle Leopold left for Belgium.
Yeah, her Uncle Leopold, and then there was Baron Stockmar. So she had a lot of father figures and adults in her, like, life, but they were never stable people for her. And this mm-hmm. is why, when Albert shows up and, you know, she immediately has a crush on him and then she just wants him to stay. So she proposes that they get married. She becomes very enraptured, but also very dependent on him because unlike every single adult person who has let her down or tried to use her in some way, at least to her, it doesn't seem like Albert wants to do that. So tactless, serious, and contentious, in other words, could be considered very German. Albert had a difficult time endearing himself to English people. There had been no precedent for him being part of the royal makeup, but he had a huge influence over Victoria until his death. She actually couldn't do much ruling when she was pregnant, so considering she was pregnant on and off from 1840 until 1857, Elber did a lot of the behind-the-scenes work. Putting her situation in perspective, between the birth of her first child in November of 1840 and the birth of her fourth child in August 1844, she was only pregnancy-free for 17 months.
That is terrible. You do not need a... I'm not going to say something inappropriate, but... Okay.
But I'm like, girl, know your cycles. Anyways. But together, they worked to stem the criticism that the royal family didn't earn its keep. In other words, the previous monarchs and kings had failed to do that. Instead, Victoria became the patron of 150 institutions, including charities, while Albert supported development of educational museums. The couple went on civic visits to industrial towns and attended military reviews to support the troops. So a lot of what happens with Victoria in the media now just focuses on how she had a life and did things when Albert died, and then she sort of fell apart, and that's pretty much it. But that's less than half of her life story, and it's also on the back end. A lot of other things did happen. There's a great documentary called Victoria's Letters, if you're, what happened after Albert died? She did a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Victoria showcases a lot of contrast that exists in our lives. So she grew up in a small, isolated childhood. She liked to keep herself out of the public eye, but she's also being utilized as a symbolic embodiment of female Britannia, and her face is on postage stamps that are used throughout the world.
Well, in some ways, so that does kind of work, because part of the reason that people's images fall apart is because you get so close to them that the parasocial relationship breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
So having that little bit of a mystique and you only see glimpses of her just further solidifies the image that she was aiming for, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and also she took advantage of new media and technology to get her image out. So the idea of some people initially when they were going to put her face on a postage stamp were thinking, is it irreverent if I'm licking the back of the queen's head?
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, no, actually, this is a great way to get her image out there. So let's do it. These contrasts continue. So like I said, she loved her husband. She loved having sex with him. She wasn't into being pregnant because she actually had postnatal depression. She wasn't a bad mom per se. She was just more hands off. But if you were raised in an isolated and constrained environment, you probably wouldn't be as touchy-feely.
Or, you know, how to go and have healthy non-codependent relationships and not knowing how to be the one who actually, you know, nurtures and is not the one who's always being taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
that's not a criticism of her, too, by the way.
No.
She's just a product of her various environments.
Totally. And I think also she did sort of burn hot and cold, and she wasn't afraid about essentially playing the favorites, you know. She was always happy to support, and if her kids wanted her advice, like, she wanted to give it to them. See, like, the thousands of letters between her and her oldest daughter when her daughter went to get married, became the Empress of Prussia when she was very young. But she was also unrelentingly harsh towards specific kids, like her I don't care for Job moments, especially with her older son Edward, her heir, because he was never as good as his father. So Victoria's tastes for virtues and limitations reflected those of the middle class. She disliked modern music. You can't drink a cup of tea to that, she said about a drinking song written by Rubinstein. She found modern paintings odd, but she was also the first sovereign to travel by train and visit France officially. The way she's, like I said, shown up in media highlights all this sort of dynamicness, you know,
mm-hmm.
who she is as a person. But it tends to paint everything she did as being either strong, independent, or to use a more popular term, woke. With her engaging and learning about things that are like, oh, I want to engage with Scottish culture, or I want to engage with Indian culture. But the reality is she's living in a time of radical change, and she's very choosy about how she wants to engage or not engage with it.
Pretty much, she will, it only has to be on her terms, and she can never actually be challenged.
Yeah. So like I said at the top, I struggled with how to look at Victoria. Do I want to be like micro and focus on her as a person, or macro, like, do I take on the British Empire?
A lot of people try to take on the British Empire.
I know. And some have succeeded, like, good for them. And there was also this pesky thing of identifying that overlap between the individual, their thoughts and feelings about things versus the actions of a nation, the government, and the society at large. So as I started to do research, I found that one of the most overlooked, relatable parts of Victoria and all her depictions, especially more the recent ones, is ignoring the fact that she's a white woman in extreme position of power and influence, And like I said, she only wanted to engage with certain politics as it suited her. Victoria is what we're being introduced to. There's either young Victoria or she's a cute old Judi Dench lady. And look how she's trying to learn about Indian arts and culture. And she has a relationship with Abdul Karim, her munchie. And she wants to learn how to speak Hindi. And isn't this nice? Like this little woke white lady. Mm-hmm. And Judi Dench does a really good job of, you know, making you think, oh, this is such a sweet story. But then, you know, you don't actually want to engage with the critical element of why does she want to engage with this? Oh, it's because she's the Empress of India and she pushed for that title. Mm-hmm. And she was insistent of why can't I be an Empress too kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to get into that, you know. And the narrative of the elderly Queen Victoria wanting to learn about a new culture and people and golden years, it makes for great story. It's a cute movie copy.
Yeah, it's best exotic Marigold Hotel.
But like in the Victorian era.
Exactly. Same type of vibe.
And I'll admit it, like there's been a lot of pieces that have come out that essentially are very weak defense points of Victoria despite the realities of empire and expansion. But she had this pattern throughout her life of picking and choosing people or things to have relationship with and engage in that were more in her favor than in the subjects that she was interested in. Mm-hmm. I found a great podcast actually called Stuff the British Stole. Highly recommend it. And it, for me, it was the third episode that solidified a new way to look at the character of Victoria. So in 1860, at the height of the Second Opium War, when the French and British troops reached the Imperial Palace in China, they stole everything in sight, including the Imperial family's 5 Pekingese dogs. According to one account, British soldiers of Peking entered the seemingly empty summer palace and found 5 little dogs near the body of a lady, possibly the emperor's aunt, who had committed suicide upon hearing the sound of approaching troops. Oof. These 5 dogs were bundled up and taken back to England. British Captain John Hart Dunn wrote his review of the event in his journal, "I have been able to retain a good many trifles I brought in the French camp, and also a pretty little dog, a real Chinese sleeve dog. It had bells around its neck. People say it's the most perfect beauty they've ever seen." 2 of the 5 dogs were claimed by Admiral John Hay and eventually found their way to Goodwood Castle and became the property of Duke of Gordon. 2 others were given to Duchess of Richmond. The 5th dog, that little beauty that Dunn wrote about, was presented to Queen Victoria, who christened the dog Ludi. The renaming seals the dog's fate as a stolen object of intense fascination. The London Illustrated News called her the smallest and by far the most beautiful creature in the UK. Harper's Weekly noted that a very small and lonely creature, the other dogs taking exception to her oriental habits and appearance. Oh, none God. Of these clippings mention that she's one of the many artifacts plundered from a flaming palace of corpses. Instead, they promote her as the ultimate symbol of colonial propaganda, cute, harmless, and an object that bridges two worlds. Queen Victoria commissioned a painting of Ludi, and she posed with, you know, a Japanese-style vase and their sort of exotic bell instrument on the floor, the trappings of...
Yep. Like, basically, like, British chinoiserie and all of that fun stuff. And they still have them chilling in their front parlors to this day. Yeah. Because they made all those replicas.
Yeah. But there's also, in contrast, there's a real-life picture of Ludi that was taken in her 4th year in England. And she's lying on an ornate chair. And she's just sitting there, little sad little dog.
I mean, if she probably went and saw her beloved owner go and commit suicide in front of her and then was separated from all of her siblings, I too would be sad.
So, yeah, it is one of those things where it's, you know, even though this dog was sort of taken in, it's, well, why was this dog needing to be taken in the first place? And then there's also the reality of Victoria wasn't unaware of the circumstances in which this dog was brought into her life. She called it Ludi, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, hearing this story about this small little dog, it broke something inside me. And then it made me go, how many of these other stories have I encountered with Victoria, the way they've been presented as like, look at this benevolent thing that she has done. But then on the other side, I'm like, benevolent for who? So here we go. The mid-19th century was a period of rapid change for Britain, the British Empire, and the British monarchy. The reason why I told you this story of the small dog is because for a long time, I could put a bunch of versions of Victoria into separate boxes that were created for her by others and frankly absolved her from a lot of her agency and responsibilities as a person. But the story of this dog made me re-examine some of those narratives about Victoria being a benevolent caretaker, especially to a number of children connected to empire. The empire was dramatically expanding in the world, with control of India transferring to direct rule of the British crown starting in 1858, trade networks in Asia and Africa plundering the nations of their natural resources. Over the course of her reign, Victoria witnessed a mammoth expansion. During the first 20 years, Britain's imperial conquests increased almost fivefold. By the time she died, it was the largest empire in the world had ever known, included a quarter of the world's population. Over this time, her image was spread across empire as a means of uniting empire's desperate peoples. Queen Victoria was a prodigious godmother. She had at least 59 godchildren. Undoubtedly, she would have been regarded as a prestigious godparent at those baptisms. Many times the instruction was to name the child after the godparent. So if it was a boy, they usually called him Victor Albert. And for girls, they called her Victoria Alexandrina, though there are a few exceptions. So Victoria took in multiple young royals from around the world as wards or godchildren. For her, it was a good way to learn about her new territories and project this benevolent image of family.
Wait a second, so pause. So there are, like, these small children from these families. Are these, like, noble families or...?
Yeah, so most of them are children who are connected with some sort of power structure. Therefore, it's almost like a royal-to-royal equalness, but... clearly, it's not everybody's coming to the table with the same amount of cachet.
And so were these kids just like taken from where they were from and then brought over to the UK?
It changes in different circumstances, but I'm going to tell you the tale of some of these children. For me, it was very much like bub kisses. Those people collect kids.
Oh my God.
And this is that thing too, where you think, Victoria, you've had 9 bio kids. How many more children do you need? Apparently...
she's a cornucopia of them.
She is a cornucopia. So despite being royal or for a lot of these children or having the queen as their guardian or godmother, the lives of these young people wasn't easy. They were feted and treated as racialized others in Victorian Britain, and their lives were pored over in that newly emerging popular press. So the same way that the dog was talked about in Harper's Magazine about, you know, look at this adorable specimen of Oriental beauty. Those were the same type of conversations that would come up with these wards and godchildren of Victoria.
So let me go and take this small child from the African continent who might have had status, but we're not going to go and acknowledge that status because our sovereignty matters more than anything. We're going to essentially rename this child, ship them up to England, and treat them basically as like a type of pet.
More or less.
You know, I understand why you led with the dog and why that would be a breaking point, but it's just like, wow, we really do have like child trafficking right now, don't we? Amazing.
Yeah, so some of these people you might have met in sort of these pop-up articles of like Victoria's, she's connected with other people and like, look at how she, you know, it's very much like, I have a black friend.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how these articles or these pieces come up. But I'm just, okay, you have to not just take it, I don't know, one off this and this. Let's see if there's a pattern emerging mm-hmm. here. So let me tell you some stories about some children.
Oof.
So born in West Africa of Yoruba descent, Sarah Forbes Bonetta was captured in 1848 at the age of 5 during the Okidean War. King Gezo of Dome was captured in the city of Okidean, sacrificing many inhabitants and leading the rest into slavery. While her family was killed in war as the daughter of an African chief, Sarah was kept in captivity as a state prisoner, either to be presented to an important visitor or to be sacrificed at the death of a minister or official to become the attendant in the next world. In June 1850, Captain Forbes on board the Bonetta arrived in Dome on a mission to negotiate for the suppression of the slave trade. While he was there, the king asked for the little girl as a present, whether for himself or on behalf of the queen wasn't clear.
So he wants to get rid of the slave trade, but he also wants this child to be a gift. I love the congratulations to the cognitive dissonance, that brain power. Wow.
Yeah. And this is something where a lot of times, especially Britain falls into this trap, and then by proxy, Canada falls into this trap too, of saying, mm-hmm. well, we got rid of slavery so much earlier than XYZ country, therefore pat self on back. But we're still doing conquesty shenanigans that, apart from literally just saying, like, calling you a slave, it's still the same messed up ideas and whatever that's playing out. So, the request was granted and the child was brought to England and was given the names Forbes Bonetta after the captain and the ship. She lived at first with Captain Forbes' family, and then on the 9th of November, she was taken to Windsor Castle and received by Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. The Queen paid for Sarah to be educated and saw her several times in the space of a few years. Sarah was an intelligent girl and developed a particular talent for music. She married in 1860 and later had a daughter, Victoria, whom the Queen acted as godmother. She is described as such by the Queen in her diary entries, saying, "Victoria, my black goddaughter." And even though we can't be sure if Victoria Davies was the first black royal godchild, it's the clear interest of the British royal family that this African family extended this relationship into a third generation. It's said that the Queen's youngest daughter, Princess Beatrice, subsequently became the godmother of Victoria Randall, who was the daughter of Davis's daughter, Beatrice Randall.
Wow.
So this is child one. Maharaja Duleep Singh of Lahore was the last Sikh ruler of the Punjab. The youngest son of Maharaja Runjit Singh, Duleep Singh was declared Maharaja of Punjab in 1843 at the age of 5. Following the British annexation of the territory in 1849, he was forced to renounce all claims of sovereignty in exchange for the British government pension of about £40,000 a year. In 1852, the young Maharaja spent some time in Missouri with the Logans, where his identity was kept hidden. Subsequently, the Logans left for England in 1854 with Duleep Singh in tow. Already set off to England, the boy's inheritance plundered from the legendary treasury of Lahore, including two valuable objects of renown, the prized and fabled Koh-i-Noor diamond, along with the fabled gold throne of Ranjit Singh. So essentially his inheritance has just been packed off as trinkets and then presented to
the Queen.
Queen Victoria was known for her affinity of England, took great personal interest in the welfare of Duleep Singh. He was treated as a member of the family and stayed at her royal residences, such as Osborne House and Balmoral. Now, Buckingham Palace, which is sort of the show palace. We have Windsor Castle, which is sort of in the countryside. But Balmoral and Osborne House are actually really like the family houses. They're private homes. Okay. So there is something about him being brought into the private home.
But he's not good enough for the public home.
That, but also it is that sort of idea of, you know, familiarity, where it's like, I'm bringing you into like the real family home. He was then formally presented the Koh-i-Noor as a gift to the sovereign. So even though it had been in her possession since it was surrendered as part of the terms of the treaty, they said, here, like, wouldn't it be cute if you actually got to give it to her as a gift? Even though it's like his diamond, even though she already had it.
Isn't that also now in, like, the imperial state crown or something?
Indeed. So he converted to Christianity in 1853, settled in England in 1840. And by this time, Maharaja Duleep Singh's Indian and Sikh identity had completely been sort of whitewashed away. In turn, he was molded into a country squire gentleman with a grand county seat in Norfolk, which became the scene of lavish parties and splendid shoots. So all the proper young Englishman things. Funded by a maintenance stipend allotted by the British, he did leave an indulgent, but it was an aimless life, and it didn't take him long to realize that this allowance was pittance compared to what his real inheritance was that he was forced to give up, sort of thing. But he was a young boy at the time, and now he's a young man. He's just realizing, wait a minute.
They really screwed us over.
Yeah, and
annexed my family's land.
Yeah. So this prompted him to try to return to Punjab to reclaim the kingdom, and a series of disastrous events and conspiracies ensued. He even tried to ally with the Russians to his cause.
Oof.
The British government was determined to thwart his plans, declaring him an outlaw, and forbade his traveling to India. He later lived in Paris and launched a renewed claim on the Punjab. He died in Paris in 1893. The heir to the once legendary Sikh kingdom died a broken man, alone and in poverty. And this was 2 years after he had had a final reconciliation with Victoria, because clearly when he's starting to assert himself and no longer playing by the rules, he's out. Queen became godmother to Duleep Singh's children, including Sophia Duleep Singh, who became a suffragette. So she's a really cool character.
Where's her movie?
I know. Princess Gormara was brought to Britain in 1852 by her father, the deposed Raj of Coorg. The Raj campaigned to win back his family wealth from the East India Company, but also asked Victoria to adopt his daughter, believing the queen could give her a good life. The Hindu Raj offered up Gormara to be baptized as a Christian in hope that Victoria would help bring her up as an adopted daughter with aristocratic guardians, secure her a good marriage. Incredibly, Victoria was also keen on this idea. Not so incredible now that we know she already has a precedent for this. And she agreed.
Well, also, she's not really considering any sort of the dynamics of in, like, continents. Like, oh, brown people are all the same.
Yeah.
Like a Sikh or a Hindu? A Muslim? What's the difference?
Yeah,
none.
Just bring them all in.
Yeah.
And also, it's like, the key is, but we make them Christians, so they're good now.
Oh, yeah.
So, Gormara particularly struggled with the attention and pressure and expectations put on her to become a model anglicized princess. Victoria willingly accepted her into royal care, but banned her from having any further contact with her father and family.
Oof.
This was supposedly to prevent her from slipping into native and heathen ways. She was moved from foster family to family as caretakers struggled with the costs and demands of a royal ward.
Does she not go and see the irony of growing up isolated from the bulk of her family and then doing that because they were considered to be a quote-unquote bad influence on her and then basically recreating the same dynamic with this young girl and then, oh, it's quote-unquote like she, like it's difficult. We can't meet the, however about that, maybe she's emotionally traumatized because she's been torn away from her culture and her family and completely isolated.
No, probably because, let's be honest, conversations like even the idea of you have trauma.
I know, but it's just that there's a certain amount of irony navel gaziness too to not be attentive to the emotional needs of others.
Yeah, well, I think also Victoria's attitude very much was nobody looked out for me. I had to look out for myself and look what I've become in spite of. As opposed to, I'm like, Victoria, you didn't really become anything. You were just sort of made queen when you were 18. So it wasn't like started from the bottom, now I'm here.
You
like,
were already at
you
the
were already there.
Yeah, you were at Apex Mountain.
Yeah. So this poor girl made repeated attempts to run away. She often spoke dearly of wanting more privacy and wanting to live independently. She even said, I'll be a maid so I can be free of scrutiny. But her actions were attributed to her innate Oriental weakness.
Oh, God.
All in told, it's a incredibly sad story. You know, a child, like you said, is feeling lost and confused, and instead it's being pushed and misunderstood by adults who are supposed to care for her. Grandma eventually married and had a child, but she was weak in health and unfortunately she died. She was only 23.
Oh.
Yeah. And in 1868, there was a British military incursion into Magdala, Ethiopia to rescue 36 European prisoners. Prince Alemayehu was the only legitimate son of Teodros II, Emperor of Abyssinia. His father ended up taking the captives when his letters to Queen Victoria were being ignored.
Mm.
So led by Sir Robert Napier, the punitive mission was extracting 13,000 soldiers, 8,000 auxiliary workers, and thousands of followers in search of adventurer's story. Several, like Richard Holmes of the British Museum, also came in search of loot.
Of course.
In the end, the emperor released the prisoners unharmed, but then committed suicide rather than surrender. What happened next was described as a deluge of fire and one of the greatest looting orgies ever undertaken in the name of the empire. Alemayehu was now an orphan, and he was put on board of the Frezo, the same ship as Holmes, who is taking back to Britain the largest haul of stolen artifacts in Ethiopia's history. The objects went to museums and libraries in Britain. Alemayehu lived with an army officer and explorer, Tristram Charles Sawyer Speedy, on the island of Wight, and was presented to Queen Victoria at Osborne House. The queen took a great interest in the child and mentioned him often in her diaries. In her diary, she said, Prince Alemayehu is a pretty, polite, graceful boy. There's nothing whatsoever of the Negro about him.
Oh, great. I mean, are we surprised?
No.
But, yeesh.
While at Osborne, Alemayehu was photographed by Julia Margaret Cameron. The multiple format prints of Alemayehu are in the royal collection, incorporating into a large album of photographs, cabinet cards, and carte de visite, indicated a great public interest in the orphan prince. I mean, Victorians love an orphan, but, like, let's not talk about why he's an orphan, right?
Well, and also, again, the Victorians loved looking at people of color, particularly black people, as basically, like, fetish objects to gaze upon.
100%.
Because they're not people. They're just to be looked at and to go and feel your own white superiority.
Yeah. Well, and this is something, too, it's, like, in the photographs, he's rendered as frail and exotic, and although she acknowledges that his was no happy life, full of difficulties of every kind, the queen doesn't consider that this unhappiness might have broken this young boy and sent him spiraling into impolite anger. What the queen wanted to imagine was that England still wanted to possess as a foreigner who earns refuge through politeness, quietness, and grace.
Yeah, she's doing him a favor, essentially.
Yeah. When Alemayehu died of pleurisy at age 18, Victoria was deeply upset, remarking, "Very grieved and shocked to hear by telegram that good Alemayehu passed away this morning. It is too sad, all alone in a strange country without a single person or relative belonging to him. Everyone is sorry." But how sorry, come on. At Queen Victoria's request, he's actually buried in St. George's Chapel in Windsor.
Dang.
A plaque reads, "When I was a stranger, ye took me in," and marks his vault. Yep. But in recent years, actually, the government of Ethiopia has requested for his remains to be repatriated to his home country, but this request has not been answered.
You know, they're always talking about how they don't have enough room there, so I'm just saying. But then again, that's like with Bartman. I cannot remember how you pronounce her name, but anyways, based on the Hottentot Venus, it took them over 100 years for them to finally go and repatriate her body back and for her to have, like, a dignity of a proper burial. So, yeah.
It is one of those things that if the monarchy sends him back, then they acknowledge, well, why was he here in the first place?
Exactly. They have to go and
reconcile with that.
Yeah.
Both Harrietta and Hare were young adults when they visited England in 1863 with a tour party of Maori people organized by William Jenkins, a Wesleyan lay preacher who had been interpreter for the Nelson provincial government. The party was presented to Queen Victoria at Osborne House on the Island of Wight in July of 1863. The queen noticed that Harriet Palmer was pregnant and expressed wish to be the child's godmother. I'm like, oh my gosh. At this point, every time you hear her being, "I love to be the godmother," I'm like, run,
bitch, run! Be like, don't even wait for a boat, swim!
I'm like, swim back! Haratara and Herr Palmer then left Jenkins' party and went to stay with Elizabeth Consello in Tottingham at the Queen's expense. On October 26th, Haratara gave birth to a son who is named Albert Victor, after the Queen's deceased husband. He was the first Maori known to be born in England. Victoria sent presents for Harrietta, £25, and for the child, a green Morocco leather case containing a silver cup, knife, spoon, and fork. Hmm. So she legitimately, we'll get into this.
She gave really good gifts.
She gave good gifts.
Like, she would, you know.
She wasn't cheap.
Yeah, she wasn't cheap.
Albert Victor was baptized at St. Paul's, Tottingham, on the 3rd of December. The next day, the couple and their son were presented to the Queen and her daughters at Windsor Castle. The Queen admired the baby and questioned Elizabeth Consello about Harata's health. Victoria told the party about how the war in New Zealand troubled her, and she hoped it would be over soon.
Jeez, I wonder why there's a war, Vicky.
Yeah. At the Queen's request, the family were photographed and equipped with clothes. The family then left England on Christmas Day on the Statesman, traveling first class with the Queen paying their fares, and arrived in Auckland in May of 1864. Hare was thought to have died in Wellington Hospital soon after returning to New Zealand.
Oof.
Harata is said to have married a man from Ngāti Hula at Okatai and to have died in the 1860s. In 1869, Duke of Edinburgh, the Queen's second son, visited New Zealand, and Albert Victor Palmer was presented to him at a great gathering of northern tribes. Albert attended St. Stephen's School in Auckland, and the Queen wanted him to join the Royal Navy, but there's no record of him having done so. He went overseas as a young man, and all record of him has been lost.
Well, I don't know why, because he just probably had a feeling, and he's like, I have to split, and then I am done. No one will find me.
Yeah. So Queen Victoria, like I said, she was keen on acquiring portraits and pictures that reflected the diversity of the human experience, culture, and society from across Britain and its empire. Within her family albums, there were photographs of these godchildren and wards, including Gorama and Sarah Forbes Bonetta. So in a way, they sort of saw each other as family, even if they were adopted members of that family. These photographs contributed to that public image of monarchy and ultimately projected one that was squeaky clean, royal model family. And over time, the monarchy's status has become more and more dependent on that opinion over time, so the need to protect that image became more and more important. Everything was to work for the benefit of the monarchy, the crown, and the British royal family. That's been a consistent theme throughout history. There are stories seen through these selective photographs and work from the royal collection connect with the broader colonial and imperial histories with the expansion of empire during this time. Victoria played that key role in terms of their education, upbringing, and comportment behavior training. So there's an element of sympathy from her that she saw them as kin in some respects because they were royal, and for a lot of them, they ended up converting to Christianity. So mm-hmm. she almost felt like it was a duty to do this. But when the godchildren fell out of favor, or like Duleep Singh, or they did anything to tarnish that model image, they would incur the wrath of the printed press and Victoria herself. We can look at Queen Victoria's actions and interactions with either good faith or bad. Maybe she was trying to use her influence to better the lives of individuals regardless of race. But
what is she? Number one, can I just interrupt? It's like, you say better. I'm like, what needed to really be improved?
Exactly. Well, it's more like, what was her underpinning motivation? And the reality is, we don't know, but I'm like, let's be honest about this. Or maybe she's just a collector of objects and people that were of interest or use to her at certain phases of her life. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to look at these interactions for what they are. Young, racialized people with little to no say are being put in a sphere of influence of one of the most powerful women in the world, and that doesn't leave room for argument or willingness of consent on their part.
Nope.
Basically, it's easy to think of Victoria as a nice white lady when really she's someone of extreme power and global influence. And I feel like that is the critical part that's missing in a lot of conversations and examinations of her actions, especially when she's being presented as, like I said, a young woman who, she's just like us. She's relatable. She has a temper. She loves her husband, or she's a nice old lady, you know, best exotic gold Marigold Hotel, but in the 1800s. And I'm thinking, there's a pattern here. Mm-hmm. There's a real person that we got to reckon with, how she actually saw and interacted with these individuals and the power structure and the play that's happening here.
Well, because the thing is, too, is that for some people, these are just how she treated some people. Like, no, that is a mini case study about how she viewed and treated her empire. Because mm-hmm. it was, in the end, her empire, because she's at the top of the food chain in terms of the British Empire.
And even though you have like the British government and you have different governments that are pushing for more empire or more takeover, at the end of the day, those governments and prime ministers, they come and go, but she's always sitting on the throne until she dies.
And also they are technically at her will, right?
It's true. They are seated at Her Majesty's pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, this was, for me, it's not a Boo Victoria Fest, but it is a real thing that, for me especially, where I'm like, you can't just cherry pick and also compartmentalize the different parts of what you like about a person, or this person's my historical fave, mm-hmm. and not actually look at the very real realities and impacts that that person had on, you know, millions of people's lives, but specifically these young people's lives, mm-hmm. and just ignore it because it doesn't fit into a nice narrative of how you want to look at a person. That's irresponsible. So anyways, thank you for coming along with me on this journey that started really when I read about this sad Pekingese dog, and my God, she had the audacity to call it Ludi.
I know.
That sort of threw me off, and then I was just like, we're going here. So
nothing you said surprised me at all.
Yes.
That's the thing. And I don't know if that disappoints me, or if it's just gotta sit with it, you know? Gotta just sit with that.
You just gotta marinate on it. And
I think also too, sometimes it's easier to go and focus on, they stole the diamond, they went and they stole like
British artifacts
and all like these cultural like mementos and everything, or they took animals, because those are things, and I mean, we all love animals, but in the end, it's a, you know, the animal eventually will learn how to go and cope. But it's a, no, this is a human being.
Yeah, this is a real person.
That's sometimes a more difficult thing to talk about and to really grapple with, because the idea of doing that to another human being is so repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, that's pretty much my deciding to how I wanted to attack Queen Victoria.
I mean, I appreciate it because, again, how do you go and you synthesize? Because there's so many different elements of her, both as a person and then also as, like, a figure, and then also just her empire writ large, that I think also maybe reframing and giving a bit more attention to the people who were directly impacted by some of her negative choices. Not a bad idea.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I how do I talk about a person? How do I talk about empire? Let's just talk about the people who she viewed as essentially her little mini empire personified.
Yeah.
And how did she decide to do that?
The moral of the story is that if an old lady who is acting like Judi Dench and Best Exotic Marigold Hotel says, oh, I really like your kid, and be cool if I became their godmom and just name them after me, hop off the boat and just start swimming.
Yeah, just swim, swim far, far away.
Amen.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.